From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Richard III improbably back in the news this week from more than 500 years ago. Shakespeare and more have made him a great villain. Here's Kevin Spacey as Richard III just last year.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York.
And that was the sweet stuff from Shakespeare's Richard before Off With His Head. He was misshapen, hunchbacked. Now his bones have been pulled out of an English parking lot for all to see. This hour on Point, Richard III and how we handle symbols of villainy. You can join the conversation. What have you thought as you stared at the skeleton, the bones of this long-gone king? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was the moment when the announcement was made Monday after months of research at the University of Leicester on a skeleton found buried under a parking lot in Leicester. Richard Buckley, Director of Archaeological Services, made the announcement.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is the academic conclusion of the University of Leicester that beyond reasonable doubt, the individual exhumed at Greyfriars in September 2012 is indeed Richard III, the last Plantagenet King of England.
And so, the return of the king. It's not as though his voice, at least as Shakespeare has it, had it, has been absent all these years, played again and again, many different settings. Here's Sir Ian McKellen playing Richard III, the 1995 film adaptation, set the play in a fictionalized fascist version of England in the 1930s. Here's McKellen as Richard, woken by fright after hearing the voices of his victims in a dream.
I'm a villain. But I lie, I am not a fool unless I speak well. Fool, do not flatter. My conscience has a thousand several tongues. Thronged to the bar, crying all guilty, guilty. I shall despair. There is no creature loves me. And if I die, no soul will pity me.
I am a villain, but I lie. No soul will pity me. We're looking at the history and the literature around Richard III in this hour. With us now from Ipswich in England is John Ashdownhill. He's an historian and member of the Richard III Society, author of The Last Days of Richard III, the book that inspired the search for Richard's remains. John was there in Leicester when the remains were exhumed. He held the cardboard box with the bones of Richard III in his lap. John Ashdownhill, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Michael Whitmore, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library, the world's largest collection of Shakespeare documents, notes, and more. Michael Whitmore, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
John, what was the sensation of sitting with a king's skeleton in your lap?
It was a very surreal moment. And I found myself thinking how weird it was that I was about to put this box with his bones in into a car, a vehicle that he wouldn't have understood at all, and that he'd actually arrived on this site by being carried through a building and through doors which were no longer there because the building had all completely disappeared. It felt very surreal.
Give us just a quick sense of how we came from that day in August in 1485. Battle of Bosworth Field, where he fell, I guess we see from these remains, with at the very least a huge battering to his skull, cleavage, to being found here in what, the remains of an old friary.
Yes, well, of course, it was very important for the person who had defeated him, who became then King Henry VII. Mm-hmm. It was very important for him to prove that Richard was dead. So he couldn't leave the body on the battlefield. He had it thrown over the back of a horse and carried into Leicester, the nearest town, where it was put on display for 2 days in a church in a suburb of Leicester called the Newark.
And rudely on display, naked, stripped naked, as I read anyway.
Well, I think it was probably not Henry the Seventh or his army directly that stripped Richard's body naked, because it was a normal thing on a battlefield in those days, possibly still is, I'm not sure, after somebody had been killed on the battlefield, for looters to come over the battlefield and take anything that was of value. And of course, a king would have been wearing very valuable armor, and Richard had actually been wearing a crown on his helmet, which apparently was taken by somebody and pushed into a hawthorn bush where it was found afterwards. And I imagine that the looter who found that was intending to come back and pick it up when it was dark and make some money out of it.
But the corpse abused after the killing, I'm reading here in the accounts of what's been found, dagger marks and more all over.
Yes. Is that very unusual? I think we had some news not so long ago about American soldiers in Afghanistan and dead Taliban, didn't we?
Not to say unusual. I guess kings are unusual for us.
I think so, yes. But I think that another point that I would make about the abuse of the body is that actually I think it was quite limited. There was one small blow with a knife to the face after death. There was a blow to the rib cage, and a sword thrust to the buttocks. But Henry VII would not have wanted the body to be disfigured. He needed this body to be recognised. So I think that he would quite quickly have put a stop to what was going on when he became aware that any of his soldiers were behaving in this way. Not because he loved Richard III, but because it was in his interests that the body should be recognisable.
And with that king's death, the Plantagenet is out and the Tudors in a great kind of talk about changing of the guard. Michael Whitmore, Shakespeare picked up Richard III. How does he rank among Shakespearean villains? Do you put him at the top or only at the top of royals? what do you say?
Well, I think he's one of the great villains. He's written earlier than some of the other villains that Shakespeare created, like Iago. And in a way, he's more interesting than Iago because he gives us a sense of why he's doing what he's doing. He's a bunch-backed toad, and there's...
His mother called him, I think, in Shakespeare's mouth.
If your mother calls you a bunch-backed toad, I don't think there's further down you can go.
Yeah.
But in addition to being slandered and having his physical deformities trotted out on stage regularly... He's aware of what other people think of him and can repeat the things that others are saying just as easily as, you know, someone else can say something about him. But he also is able to reflect on that and then say, here's why I should turn to seduction, I should turn to murder, I want to be king, because there's nothing left for me in this world. So... I think in a way he's not quite as frightening as someone like Iago from Shakespeare's Othello, who just seems evil for reasons we can't even understand. I think Richard is a more understandable villain, but he's also a villain with great panache. He takes pleasure in describing what he's going to do to others. Mm. He is incredibly persuasive and energetic. You know, he's able to seduce a woman. Pardon me?
And bold, seducing the widow of a man he's just killed.
Oh, yes. When he meets Lady Anne, who's there with the corpse of her father-in-law, they have this exchange where she begins by insulting him, and he takes the opportunity to seduce her. So she's speaking to him, and he says, "Never came poison from so sweet a place." And she says, "Never hung poison on a fowler toad. Out of my sight thou dost infect my eyes." And listen to how he turns it. "Thine eyes, sweet lady, have infected mine."
Shameless and potent and ready to go, even there in the presence of the corpse. John Ashton Hill, we've seen a lot of Richard III society people quoted as looking like they're very ready to rehabilitate the reputation of Richard III on the back of this discovery, this confirmation of the identity of this skeleton. Are you in that crowd? Did Shakespeare do him wrong?
Shakespeare, of course, was writing 100 years after Richard died, and he was writing in the context of the Tudor regime, which was the political system which took over from Richard III. Now, we know in modern political systems as well, if a leader is thrown out and his enemies take over, what they write about him is not polite. So Shakespeare had no access to any other kind of material. The only material he had access to was hostile to Richard. But also, I think we need to remember that Shakespeare wasn't writing history. Shakespeare was writing a play to entertain the Londoners of his day, and he did that very well, and it was very successful. But he wasn't trying to write history, and the connection between Shakespeare's Richard III and the real Richard III is just in the name, quite honestly.
Shakespeare has him say, "I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasure of these days. Many have played him." Here was Laurence Olivier, Sir Laurence Olivier, 1955, Richard III.
"Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried."
You know him for that speech and many, many more. He was a quote machine in the hands of William Shakespeare. My horse, my kingdom, for a horse. John Ashton Hill, please stand by in Ipswich, England, with the Richard III Society. Very glad you're here. Author of The Last Days of Richard III. Michael Whitmore, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington. Please stand by as well. And listeners, you can join us. Did you see the shape of Richard's spine in those photographs? Would that make you an angry king? Can you believe he was under a parking lot? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Richard III, back from the dead, the bones of Shakespeare's great villain king, found under an English parking lot. We're looking at the man, the myth, the monarch, Richard III. You can join us. Do you believe Shakespeare got him right? The king who the bard had say, "My kingdom for a horse, the winter of our discontent, off with his head." Do you believe Richard was an angry man, a villain, or the victim of his vanquisher's propaganda? The skeleton found, that remarkable curvature of the spine, scoliosis, can create something like a hunchback, and of course that's what he's come down to us known as having suffered. DNA also put to work to track down the connection here. The DNA of his closest living male descendant, Canadian Michael Ibsen, was used to help identify the body of the long-lost king. Here's Michael Ibsen in an interview with the BBC after the remains were first found in September.
"On Friday, when I was up at the site and standing right in front of the actual place where they found the remains, and it was one of those sort of hairs in the back of your neck go up and tingle up your spine. You think you've got this connection with history. Extraordinary."
Extraordinary indeed. And here he is talking with the Daily Telegraph on how it feels to know of his royal lineage, the Canadian furniture maker, Michael Ibsen.
"Here, we think, has lain Richard III for 500 years. And there's a link between myself and this man. Extraordinary, really."
No kidding, that is extraordinary. And here, again from Shakespeare, this is Kenneth Branagh playing Richard III in an audiobook version of the play. Here, a frustrated Richard searches for a horse on the battlefield in one of the play's most famous lines.
"I have set my life upon a cast, and I will stand the hazard of the die. I think there be 6 Richmonds in the field. 5 have I slain today instead of him. A horse! A horse! My kingdom!
John Ashton Hill joins us from Ipswich in England, historian, member of the Richard III Society, author of The Last Days of Richard III. Michael Whitmore is with us, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. John Ashdown Hill, in England, a horse, my kingdom for a horse. Is there history to suggest why he may have been yelling that?
Oh, I think there is. Whether he actually said those words or not, we can't be sure. But what happened at the Battle of Bosworth was that for some reason, and we don't really know why he did this, Richard, who had a much larger army and was in a commanding position and really should have won the battle, suddenly decided to launch a charge downhill at his enemy, who he could see on the lower ground. And his charge ran into problems, and Richard was pushed back, and he seems to have been unhorsed. I think it's clear from his body that when he was unhorsed, possibly his horse was killed underneath him, and he fell. His helmet must have come off because he had been wearing a helmet, but we know now that he was killed by severe blows to the head. And I think that at that stage, apart from Shakespeare's version, we also have other versions that say that one of Richard's squires offered him a horse so that he could escape, and he refused and said no, he would stay and fight. So I think there is probably some truth behind what Shakespeare has him saying there.
Our listeners responding with all kinds. I mean, some humor, disapproval of a villain or questions anyway, and some sympathy. I mean, Ted says, of course, he would be found in a parking lot, the oldest parking lot known to history. His last words, a horse. A parking lot would be a logical place to follow up on. Oh, I don't know.
for want of a horse, he ended up in a parking lot.
Yes. Chino says, revisionist history by the winning side. Nice kings get vilified by their usurpers, and tyrants get the shrines. I don't know. We'll test that. And Brett, a little sympathetic here, says the photo of his skeletal remains. And if you've seen this, there's an unbelievable kind of U in his spine from scoliosis. Brett says, shows the severity of his scoliosis. It's a progressive condition and would have been quite painful at that stage. And here he died on the battlefield. Michael Whitmore, he's often presented as that outcast, self-loathing, but with some reason here. I mean, there's an infliction that he's suffering that makes him miserable, and then what? Turns around and inflicts misery on the world. Is that literary license? Is that human reality?
I think it's literary license. I don't think there's really a reliable way to go from the condition that he had and this disability to an explanation for why Shakespeare would have depicted him in this way, or even for the way in which he ruled. As John has said, it's really a question of coming to terms with who this man was in the absence of really knowing him or being close to him. I think the theatrical story about who this man was begins as soon as Henry VII decides to put the body on display, because Henry knows that people do pay attention to kings, and in these transitional moments, it's important for rulers to show the public what's happened. So I would say that Shakespeare's not the first person. In fact, he's not the first person to write about Richard III. Thomas More did, and some of Shakespeare's sources like Hall and Holinshed told these stories. But I would focus on the moment that John has talked about, which is when those in the new ruling family realize that they need to make a symbolic transition of power, and they have a very powerful prop, which is the corpse of the dead king.
Well, I mean, we'll go to that, but let's be fair with a critical eye for a moment here. John Ashdown Hill, in England, Richard III killed a lot of people, or had them killed, on his way to the throne.
Ah, where is your evidence for that, Tom? Shakespeare certainly has him killing a lot of people on his way to the throne, but actually we have very little evidence for that.
I mean,
Shakespeare says that he killed the previous king, Henry VI.
Yes.
There is no evidence for that. Shakespeare says that he killed his brother, the Duke of Clarence. The Duke of Clarence was actually executed by King Edward IV, having had a trial before Parliament.
What about the famous nephews in the Tower of London? I've been there and had them, what, a beef eater, give me the gruesome details of how 9 and 12 years old, and down they went at his evil hand.
Well, honestly, we have no knowledge of whether these children were killed or not. Richard III took the throne over their heads, as it were, on the grounds that they were illegitimate. And in my view, he had a good case, and he put the evidence to Parliament, and Parliament backed his case and offered the crown to him. Having done that, there was no necessity for Richard to kill them because he'd had them ruled illegitimate. So they were out of the line of succession.
But now
we don't actually know what happened to them. Mm. But there were people who later came forward pretending to be the younger one of them.
Yep.
And actually, lots of people recognized him as the younger one, and maybe he was.
But are you speaking now, John, as a rectifying champion of Richard III or as an historian?
I'm speaking as a historian. I'm saying we don't know. There are bodies buried in Westminster Abbey with a label on the urn saying that they are the princes in the Tower. Those bodies were found 200 years later in the course of some rebuilding work at the Tower of London. We don't know whether they're male bodies or female bodies. We don't know whether there are two or three or more. We don't know from what period they date. They could be Roman, they could be Anglo-Saxon. There is actually no clear evidence that these two children died or that they died in the Tower of London. They may have done, and Richard may have had them put to death, but there isn't any evidence.
Let's go to our listeners. Gina is calling from Antioch, Tennessee. Gina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. The question I have is, has Queen Elizabeth or anyone from the royal family made a statement regarding this discovery since his death pretty much put them on the throne and they have a lot invested?
I should say, two things there. John, first of all, can you draw a line between his death and Queen Elizabeth sitting on the throne?
Yes, very clearly. Queen Elizabeth is a descendant of Henry Tudor, who defeated Richard.
That's Elizabeth I, right?
Elizabeth, and also Elizabeth II, the present queen.
The present queen, and have they said anything about it? I mean, after all, yeah, it was a real tussle back then, to say the very, very, very least, wore the roses. is Michael Ibsen, the furniture maker, going to raise an army outside the gates of Buckingham Palace now and march on the queen?
I very much doubt it. Michael Ibsen is a charming person and a very good friend and a very quiet chap, and I don't think that he would have any ambition to sit on a throne. There haven't been any statements from Her Majesty the Queen in person, there have been statements from her cousin, His Royal Highness the Duke of Gloucester, mm-hmm. the present Duke of Gloucester. He has the title that Richard III had before he came to the throne. When I first found the DNA link in 2005, he asked to have information about that, and I gave a presentation to him on that. And I think that when the reburial takes place of the bones that have been found, it is very probable that His Royal Highness the Duke of Gloucester will attend the reburial.
May I ask about the genetic link? How did this work? How did they know after 17 generations that Michael Ibsen was his great-great-great-nephew or something, I guess?
Well, it's a complicated story. I mean, I started this the search for the genetic link in 2003, and it had nothing to do with Richard III at all, but it was to do with some bones that had been found in Belgium that were thought to be remains of Richard III's sister, Margaret, who'd mm-hmm. married the Duke of Burgundy. Mm-hmm. And Belgian colleagues asked me if I could find a DNA sequence so that they could test these bones against them. And I tried, first of all, dead DNA. The Ashmolean Museum in Oxford gave me some strands of Edward IV's hair, who was the eldest brother of the family. But unfortunately, it was too degraded, and we couldn't get DNA from that. So I was then left with nothing but the possibility of trying to find a living descendant. And I tried to trace an all-female line so that the mitochondrial DNA would be the same. And it's very difficult over a long period, and an enormous family tree grew on my computer. But eventually, in 2004, I got to Joy Ibsen, Michael's mother, who was then living in London, Ontario, in Canada. And with great nervousness, I picked up the phone and contacted her because I didn't know how she would react to suddenly being told that she was related to medieval royalty and asked for a sample of her DNA.
Incredible. And then the skeleton itself and the severity of the curvature in that spine, one can only imagine what it must have been like to live with that. And this is scoliosis, which what shows up in adolescent or teenage years, and then it's progressively worse, at least for a while. I mean, that was some burden to carry, one would think.
Well, the scoliosis has different kinds, but okay. in the case of Richard III, it does seem to be adolescent onset scoliosis, and we don't know exactly what caused it. But I'm not sure, Tom, which picture of the skeleton you're looking at. There is a picture I've seen on the internet of the
body. Looks
like
it's on black velvet sublying somewhere.
Then I think that's misleading. I think that's misleading because the bones there are laid out separately. If you look at the arm bones and mm-hmm. the hand bones, mm-hmm. they're all spread out. And I think the skull is separate from the rest of the skeleton. Mm-hmm. It's not coordinated. So I don't think that very severe curvature represents quite the true position. If you look at photographs on the internet of the body before it was taken out of the grave. You can also see the scoliosis there, but I think it's less severe.
Well, then I don't know quite what to say about it. It seems to have been taken as evidence that indeed he was grappling with some real challenge there in his skeleton. We're talking about Richard III this hour, the man, the myth, the monarch. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Shakespeare made much of it. This is a little bit from Richard III, the World Shakespeare Festival in London. Here's Richard, played by Jonjo O'Neill, frustrated by his physical misshapen appearance.
I, that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to see my shadow in the sun and descant on mine own deformity.
From Shakespeare, Richard III there, speaking of himself, made up so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Michael Whitmore, Shakespeare was fascinated with deformity, I think.
Well, it's an incredible characterization, and I think Shakespeare is a writer who takes a germ of an idea that he gets from his reading or the world that he sees, and then he develops it dramatically. This is a very dramatic speech because it's delivered directly to the audience, and he's giving us a sense of how he feels about himself. And the language is so rich and explicit. He can look at his own shadow and see from the shape of that shadow someone that he himself hates. I think Shakespeare took a lot of license here with the historical record, but I would say he took a lot of license everywhere. Shakespeare didn't think of himself as a historian. He thought of himself as presenting English history to people who would look to it for a sense of themselves as part of a nation, but also sometimes moral edification and instruction. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Tudor regime, I think that Shakespeare's histories are showing a particular story about history, which is that a usurpation that took place earlier on in this sequence of plays that led up to Richard III, that is the deposition of Richard II, started a sequence of events that led to a monarch, Richard III, who was a scourge on English history and on English people. So there's a view of history in the 16th and 17th centuries that says God will punish wrongs, and sometimes he'll do it with someone who is himself evil. So I think that the storytelling that's going on here and the embellishment could serve a lot of purposes, but certainly his audience and the partisans of the Tudor regime looking at the play would have seen a kind of divine judgment on the people who had initially created political violence earlier on.
Divine justice in Richard's villainy in Shakespeare's hands. Anyway, Michael Whitmore at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington. Please stand by. John Ashton Hill in Ipswich, England with the Richard III Society. Listeners, you can join us. Do you believe Richard was an angry man, a villain, the victim of the vanquisher's propaganda? Do you wonder if you're the 17th generation descendant of some king, some queen? Would you say yes if they asked for a swab? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Richard III, back from the dead, the bones of Shakespeare's great villain king, found under an English parking lot. We're looking at the man, the myth, the monarch, with John Ashdown-Hill, author of The Last Days of Richard III, historian, member of the Richard III Society. He held the box containing the remains of Richard III in his lap after it left the site under the parking lot. Michael Whitmore is with us from the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington. And you can join us. What does all this leave you thinking? Are old kings and queens more important for their real history or for what we've made them stand for? Villainy, chivalry. What's your question, your thought on Richard III? What's your favorite actor in the role? Al Pacino played Richard III on and off Broadway in the 1970s and 1996 in his directorial debut, looking for Richard. He took on the role of Richard III again. Here he is as Richard explaining his plans for Lady Anne.
I will marry the beautiful Lady Anne.
What?
Though I killed her husband and his father. The readiest way to make the wench amends is to become her husband and her father.
To become her husband and her father. Shakespeare's Richard III toured the world, led by Kevin Spacey in the role in 2011. Here's Spacey as Richard and Annabelle Sholey as Lady Anne at the Brooklyn Academy of Music last year.
Curse not thyself, fair creature.
I would I were to be revenged on thee.
It is a quarrel most unnatural to be revenged on him that loveth thee.
It is a quarrel just and reasonable to be revenged on him that killed my husband.
To be revenged on him that killed my husband, and now we see the bones and reconsider all the legend and lore and literature and history. Mia is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to say that, I don't think it's a big mystery, the question of what did he mean by a horse, my kingdom, for horse. If I may be so bold, I'm a scoliotic myself, and I think that we've tended to now talk about, well, whether the deformity was as big as we think, but really, you know, as someone with five rods in my back and three surgeries behind me, I can tell you even the smallest deformity would have caused him incredible, a true torturous, just horrifying pain. And so I think he probably was willing to trade his kingdom for a horse because he was probably in an excruciating pain, the first point. And the second is, I just wanted to say that I think we tend to really forget how co-constituting the way that behavior and physicality tend to, you know, work for and against people. I feel like it's just certain that Shakespeare used King Richard's the third scoliosis politically to further demonize him, because we do associate certain kinds of physicality as a pure or evil judgment from God. So, you know, the deformity as a divine judgment against him, as you said. So this misshapen framing by Shakespeare, I think, was purely political. And for those modern day scoliotics, I think it's a little bit painful even to hear how easily we, you know, framed him as this, you know, outcast, really because of the way that he looked, in addition to, or because of, maybe, furthered by the way that he looked.
Mia, I'm so grateful for your insight. I mean, here you're dealing with this and commenting on it at the same time, the actual physical condition. And maybe Shakespeare was made a propagandist here, but then Shakespeare's no mean interpreter of human nature himself. I'm reading here Mia Anthony Scher, who played Richard III for the Royal Shakespeare Company at one time. You know, he talks about him as a man who, because of that deformity, has experienced a lot of prejudice, even hatred. This, in turn, has filled him with self-hatred. I mean, I can hear, Mia, the way in which you're kind of affronted by Shakespeare, but can you also imagine that this could have been a king who did feel some rage? I mean, Shakespeare has him say, you know, I can't strut before a wanton ambling nymph, you know, can't be with a woman. I'll hate the idle pleasure of these days. What about the notion that he, even beyond the hatred that may have been directed at him because of it, perhaps, that he may have had his own anger about it, Mia?
Oh, absolutely. I think I'm both affronted and from my own personal experience, you know, rage has been a sort of a regular part of my own life, given the pain. I mean, it's very difficult not to be at times self-loathing and wishing that you didn't have this deep pain. And actually, it would be almost incoherent to expect that somebody who would regularly experience pain, and again, I feel very certain that mm-hmm. he did, given my own experience, mm-hmm. that it would be quite difficult for him to not experience both periods of self disdain, and therefore mm-hmm. perhaps projection and rage outwardly.
If you were a king or ruling queen in that time, can you imagine sort of? You'd have to be saintly almost not to take some of that out.
Of course. And not only that, he would have had to repress quite a lot of it mm-hmm. Because of the mores and the certain sort of traditions.
Sure.
Yet, while at the same time, everybody's thinking what they were thinking about his physicality. So it must have been quite a complex thing to be King Richard III.
Mia, you are generous royalty unto us. We thank you very, very much for those insights and that call. Let me get one more and I'll take it to my guests. Dean in Columbia, South Carolina. Dean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm a graduate instructor at South Carolina down here, and we went over or covered Richard III this week, actually. I couldn't have planned it any better.
Genius.
And I asked my students, you know, what they thought about him as a character, as a person, and so my male students appreciated his ability to seduce Lady Anne especially. But when I put up the picture of the skeleton and we looked at the spine, it actually induced a lot of pity out of them because he is put in a situation where he has to fight, you know, on this battlefield.
Yeah.
And hearing Shakespeare describe him as a hunchback toad is one thing, but to see the skeleton, and it really drove home for them what it would be like for this person with a physical limitation to have to do battle. And they kind of, their opinion on him sort of changed in turn. It was interesting to see their opinion change.
I felt some of the same myself, Dean, and I'm very grateful for your call as well. John Ashton-Hill, first to this issue of his physical condition. Mia has wrestled with the same thing, scoliosis, and she looks with sympathy of, you know, very nuanced kinds of sympathy here. You said the photograph may, from certain angles, exaggerate the curvature of his spine, but does it not look as though it were serious enough to be a significant major factor in his life?
Well, I think the point that we have to remember, and I take on board everything that Mia said, I think she made some very important points, but whatever he suffered, Richard was a significant military commander. He was able to wield the weapons of his day. He was able to wear the heavy armor. He may have been in pain. He may have been suffering, but he was able to do these things. So somehow he overcame it. And I think that's important to remember because in the 16th century, when the accounts of him as a hunchback were written, it was equated with evil. Physical disability was seen as a sign of evil. I hope we're not living in that world now. I hope we don't make that equation now. I think we should separate those two things, and we should take on board, okay, he had this disability, but somehow he managed to overcome it.
Michael, I find myself here uncertain how to think about. Here, Shakespeare makes such a vivid creation, mm-hmm. and it has utility. It helps us think about, you know, good and evil and villainy and its opposite and nobility and pain and how any individual may handle it. It may not line up exactly with the historical Richard III. I don't know if we'll ever really know. Does that diminish the value of Shakespeare's exercise?
Oh, not at all. I think we ask Shakespeare, we don't ask him to be the best historian. We ask him to tell a story about people and to tell that story in a way that lets us have some insight into why they act the way that they do. I do think that Richard III as portrayed in the play is at times a caricature. And when the part was played by Kevin Spacey at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where it played in the States, it was quite over the top. And that connects with one tradition. It's a medieval morality play tradition where you've got a kind of a caricature figure called Vice, who is evil and is also quite entertaining. But I think there are moments at the end of the play after Richard has seen the ghosts of his victims, and you played a little bit of Ian McKellen saying these lines, where he's really taking two positions at once and saying, I know that I am going to be judged harshly and look at the terrible things I've done. And then on the other hand, he says, I have to be sympathetic to myself. So, you know, what I look to Shakespeare for is that sense of nuance. And I also think that, you know, Mia's comments were really insightful and helpful. I also think they kind of opened the door for us to think about the ways in which many people, all people, could identify with some part of Richard, because we all experience being outsiders in one way or another, some more than others. But there might be a kind of inkling of sympathy for Richard because he's very good at talking about what it's like to be on the outside.
We heard Ian McKellen there again saying, my conscience, as Richard, my conscience hath a thousand several tongues thronged to the bar, crying all, guilty, guilty. I shall despair. There is no creature loves me, and if I die, no soul will pity me. Is there any evidence, Michael, that you see here? I mean, we have learned through holding history up to story and symbol, villainy is very often our projection. That's a pattern we see again and again. Is there evidence that Shakespeare had that nuance even in his own play, Richard III, or not?
Well, I think if you talk about Shakespeare and don't talk about nuance, you're probably not talking about
Shakespeare.
But
what about this nuance in this play?
I'd make a comparison. You know, we know that in politics, there are many views on people, but there's also, take for example, Richard Nixon. In the aftermath of Watergate, I think we told the story of him and the things he did and maybe even his motives in a certain way. And that's something that Shakespeare, I think, does with Richard. I wouldn't confine it to Shakespeare. I would say that we still look to artists to tell us why people act the way that they do. And if they do things that upset us, we assume it's because the character is evil. And then we've got a problem. We've got to explain why. But when I bring up the example of Nixon, I'm not making a judgment on what he did, but I think it shows that we still want to hear stories about people that tell us, here's why this person acted the way that he did.
We learn from literature. We learn from Bones, the Bones of Richard III, up and identified this week. Michael Whitmore, John Ashton Hill, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. John is calling from New York City. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I really love the turn the conversation has just taken. I think that we always have to remember that Shakespeare is always thinking more widely and more deeply than we can imagine. And I think that I have some experience with the play, and I think that we need to remember that there's a difference. I always try to draw a distinction between the factual or actual man and a theatrical creation.
Of course.
The theatrical creation holds just what your guest just said from the Folger, just all sorts of lessons about humanity, about the idea of how we see ourselves, about how we, what we do with our own self-loathing, whether it spills over onto others, questions of power and corruption, etc. And I think that, you know, while there are some connections between these two creatures, the theatrical creature is very distinct and holds lessons that the facts, you know, there. What is that idea? Lies like truth. That
yes.
A play, the ideas about Richard are actually very useful for our own humanity and our own lives.
Absolutely. John, thank you for that. John Ashton Hill, if I may bring that to you. I mean, here we have Shakespeare for centuries now, And now, just in these few days, we have the skeleton before the world and a lot of history along that. What's the importance of holding history's evidence up against our literature, even Shakespeare, John Ashton Hill?
Well, I think all of us care about what our reputation is, don't we, and how people see us. And I'm sure Richard would be concerned if he could express it for himself at the reputation he's had to live with for the last 500 years. I mean, we've heard several scenes between from Shakespeare's play between Richard and Anne. Mm-hmm. Richard was brought up with Anne. He was brought up by her father. He grew up with her. He knew her from when she was a little girl. She was forced to marry her first husband against her will, and all the signs are that she and Richard had a very loving relationship. So Shakespeare's play is not true on that point. We've also heard examples of how Shakespeare has Richard's mother, Cecily, the Duchess of York, talking about her son. If you look at the correspondence that survives between Richard and his mother, it's very respectful correspondence. And what did Richard do just before going to the Battle of Bosworth, where he lost his life? He went to visit his old mother because she just had her 70th birthday. I think that we need to take account of the fact that Shakespeare is demonstrably writing a play and not writing history.
But are you saying with that that there's some kind of whole cloth infamy in Shakespeare's depiction, a twisting of a good man?
If I may, John.
Carry on, Michael.
I think there's a difference between fiction and history, but what's so startling about the events that have taken place in Leicester is that no matter how far afield fiction can go, and I think Shakespeare does improvise and do what playwrights do, there is still the fact that there was this man who existed, and that Shakespeare was writing about that man. And the fact that his bones survive and have been identified really does make that link again for us. And it's a very powerful one. When I see Richard Burbage's signature on documents at the Folger, and Burbage played this part, I'm taken back to the fact that while we have these wonderful stories, in the case of history plays, they are pointed at real people. And getting that link back, I think, has to ground us in some way.
A slandered man, John Ashton Hill?
I think a slandered man. I think if you look at the real Richard III, why did he die at the Battle of Bosworth? Why did he end up with this bad reputation? It was because he was actually too nice for his own good. If he'd really been a villain, he would actually have killed the enemies that survived to ruin his reputation after he was dead.
Well, and there turns the world. We'll have to carry some history and literature and plenty of nuance in our own sense of the man, the king, as we've come to know it in this week. It's really been interesting. John Ashton Hill with the Richard III Society, author of The Last Days of Richard III, joining us from Ipswich. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
And Michael Whitmore at the Folger Shakespeare Library. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.